"How do you like that, nigger dog?" Henry asked it, and it rolled its dying eyes up at the sound of Henry's voice and tried to wag its tail. "Did you like your lunch, you shitty mutt?" When the dog was dead, Henry removed the clothesline, went home, and told his father what he had done. Oscar Bowers was extremely crazy by that time. A year later, his wife would leave him after he beat her nearly to death. Henry was likewise frightened of his father and felt a terrible hate for him sometimes, but he also loved him. And that afternoon, after he had told, he felt he had finally found the key to his father's affections, because his father had clapped him on the back so hard that Henry almost fell over, taken him in the living room, and given him a beer. It was the first beer Henry had ever had, and for all the rest of his years he would associate that taste with positive emotions, victory and love. "Here's to a good job well done," Henry's crazy father had said. They clicked their brown bottles together and drank them down. So far as Henry knew, the niggers had never found out who killed their dog. But he supposed they had their suspicions. He hoped they did. The others in the Losers Club knew Mike by sight. In a town where he was the only Negro child, it would have been strange if they had not. But that was all, because Mike didn't go to Derry Elementary School. His mother was a devout Baptist, and Mike was therefore sent to the Nebolt Street Church School. In between geography, reading, and arithmetic, there were Bible drills, lessons on such subjects as the meaning of the Ten Commandments in a godless world, and discussion groups on how to handle everyday moral problems. If you saw a buddy shoplifting, for instance, or heard a teacher taking the name of God in vain. Mike thought the church school was okay. There were times when he suspected, in a vague way, that he was missing some things. A wider communication with kids his own age, perhaps. But he was willing to wait until high school for these things to happen. The prospect made him a little nervous because his skin was brown, but both his mother and father had been well treated in town as far as Mike could see, and Mike believed he would be treated well if he treated others the same way. The exception to this rule, of course, was Henry Bowers. Although he tried to show it as little as possible, Mike went in constant terror of Henry. In 1958, Mike was slim and well-built, taller than Stan Uris, but not quite as tall as Bill Denbro. He was fast and agile, and that had saved him from several beatings at Henry's hands. And, of course, he went to a different school. Because of that and the age difference, their paths rarely coincided. Mike took pains to keep things that way. So the irony was this. Although Henry hated Mike Hanlon more than any other kid in Derry, Mike had been the least hurt of any of them. Oh, he had taken his lumps. The spring after he had killed Mike's dog, Henry sprang out of the bushes one day while Mike was walking toward town to go to the library. It was late March, warm enough for bike riding, but in those days Witcham Road turned to dirt just beyond the Bowers place, which meant that it was a quagmire of mud, no good for bikes. "Hello, nigger," Henry had said, emerging from the bushes, grinning. Mike backed off, eyes flicking warily right and left, watching for a chance to get away. He knew that if he could buttonhook around Henry, he could outdistance him. Henry was big and Henry was strong, but Henry was also slow. "Gonna make me a tar baby," Henry said, advancing on the smaller boy. "You're not black enough, but I'll fix that." Mike cut his eyes to the left and twitched his body in that direction. Henry took the bait and broke that way, too fast and too far to pull himself back. Reversing with a sweet and natural speed, Mike took off to the right. In high school, he would make the varsity football team as a tailback his sophomore year, and was only kept from breaking the school's all-time scoring record by a broken leg halfway through his senior season. He would have made it easily past Henry, but for the mud. It was greasy, and Mike slipped to his knees. Before he could get up, Henry was upon him. "Nigger, nigger, nigger," Henry cried in a kind of religious ecstasy as he rolled Mike over. Mud went up the back of Mike's shirt and down the back of his pants. He could feel it squeezing into his shoes. But he did not begin to cry until Henry slathered mud across his face, plugging up both of his nostrils. "Now you're black," Henry had screamed gleefully, rubbing mud in Mike's hair. "Now you're really black." He ripped up Mike's poplin jacket and the T-shirt beneath and slammed a poultice of mud down over the boy's belly button. "Now you're as black as midnight in a mine shaft," Henry screamed triumphantly, and slammed mud plugs into both of Mike's ears. Then he stood back, muddy hands hooked into his belt, and yelled, "I killed your dog, black boy." but Mike did not hear this because of the mud in his ears and his own terrified sobs. Henry kicked a final sticky clot of mud onto Mike and then turned and walked home, not looking back. A few moments later, Mike got up and did the same, still weeping. His mother was, of course, furious. She wanted Will Hanlon to call Chief Borton and have him out to the Bowers' house before the sun went down. "He's been after Mikey before," Mike heard her say. He was sitting in the bathtub and his parents were in the kitchen. This was his second tub of water. The first had turned black almost the moment he had stepped into it and sat down. In her fury, his mother had lapsed into a thick Texas patois Mike could barely understand. "You put the law on him, Will Hanlon. Both the dog and the pup. You law him, hear me?" Will heard, but did not do as his wife asked. Eventually, when she cooled down, by then it was that night and Mike 2 hours asleep, he refreshed her on the facts of life. Chief Borton was not Sheriff Sullivan. If Borton had been sheriff when the incident of the poisoned chickens occurred, Will would never have gotten his $200 and would have had to be content with that state of affairs. Some men would stand behind you and some men wouldn't. Borton was of the latter type. He was, in fact, a jellyfish. "Mike has had trouble with that kid before, yes," he told Jessica. "But he hasn't had much because he's careful around Henry Bowers. This will serve to make him more careful."
"You mean you're just going to let it go?"
"Bowers has told his son stories about his dealings with me, I guess," Will said. "And his son hates the three of us because of them, and because his father has also told him that hating niggers is what men are supposed to do. It all comes back to that. I can't change the fact that our son is a Negro any more than I can sit here and tell you that Henry Bowers is going to be the last one to take after him because his skin's brown. He's going to have to deal with it all the rest of his life, as I have dealt with it, and you have dealt with it." "Why, right there in that Christian school you were bound he was going to go to, the teacher told them blacks weren't as good as whites because Noah's son Ham looked at his father while he was drunk and naked, and Noah's other two boys cast their eyes aside. That's why the sons of Ham were condemned to always be hewers of wood and drawers of water," she said. "And Mikey said she was looking right at him while she told that story to them." Jessica looked at her husband, mute and miserable. Two tears fell, one from each eye, and tracked slowly down her face.
"Isn't there ever any getting away from it?"
His reply was kind but implacable. It was a time when wives believed their husbands, and Jessica had no reason to doubt her will. "No, there is no getting away from the word nigger. Not now, not in the world we've been given to live in, you and me. Country niggers from Maine are still niggers. I have thought, times, that the reason I came back to Derry was that there is no better place to remember that. But I'll have a talk with the boy." The next day he called Mike out of the barn. Will sat on the yoke of his harrow and patted a place next to him for Mike. "You want to stay out of that Henry Bowers' way," he said. Mike nodded. "His father is crazy." Mike nodded again. He had heard as much around town. His few glimpses of Mr. Bowers had reinforced the notion. "I don't mean just a little crazy," Will said, lighting a home-rolled Bugler cigarette and looking at his son. "He's about 3 steps away from the booby hatch. He came back from the war that way."
"I think Henry's crazy, too," Mike said.
His voice was low but firm, and that strengthened Will's heart. Although he was, even after a checkered life whose incidents had included almost being burned alive in a jury-rigged speakeasy called the Black Spot, unable to believe a kid like Henry could be crazy. "Well, he's listened to his father too much, but that is only natural," Will said. Yet on this, his son was closer to the truth. Henry Bowers, either because of his constant association with his father or because of something else, some interior thing, was indeed slowly but surely going crazy. "I don't want you to make a career out of running away," his father said, "but because you're a Negro, you're apt to be put upon a good deal. Do you know what I mean?"
"Yes, Daddy," Mike said, thinking of Bob Gautier at school, who had tried to explain to Mike that nigger could not be a bad word because his father used it all the time.
In fact, Bob told Mike earnestly it was a good word. When a fighter on the Friday night fights took a bad beating and managed to stay on his feet, his daddy said, "His head is as hard as a nigger's." And when someone was really putting out at his work, which for Mr. Gautier was star beef in town, his daddy said, "That man works like a nigger." "And my daddy is just as much a Christian as your daddy," Bob had finished. Mike remembered that,
looking at Bob Gautier's white, earnest, pinched face, surrounded by the mangy fur of his hand-me-down snowsuit hood, he had felt not anger, but a terrible sadness that made him feel like crying. He had seen honesty and good intent in Bob's face, but what he had felt was loneliness, distance, a great whistling emptiness between himself and the other boy. "I see that you do know what I mean," Will said, and ruffled his son's hair. "And what it all comes down to is that you have to be careful where you take your stand. You have to ask yourself if Henry Bowers is worth the trouble. Is he?"
"No," Mike said. "No, I don't think so."
It would be yet a while before he changed his mind. July 3rd, 1958, in fact. 4. While Henry Bowers, Victor Criss, Belch Huggins, Peter Gordon, and a half-retarded high school boy named Steve Sadler, known as Moose, after the character in the Archie comics, were chasing a winded Mike Hanlon through the train yard and toward the Barrens about a half a mile away, Bill and the rest of the Losers Club were still sitting on the bank of the Kanduskeag, pondering their nightmare problem.
"I know where it is, I think," Bill said, finally breaking the silence.
"The sewers,"
Stan said, and they all jumped at a sudden, harsh, rattling noise. Eddie smiled guiltily as he lowered his aspirator back into his lap. Bill nodded.
"I was asking my father about the sewers of a few heights ago."
"All of this area was originally marsh," Zach told his son, "and the town fathers managed to put what's downtown these days in the very worst part of it. The section of the canal that runs under Center and Main and comes out in Basie Park is really nothing but a drain that happens to hold the Kanduskeag. Most of the year, those drains are almost empty, but they're important when the spring runoff comes or when there are floods." He paused here, perhaps thinking that it had been during the flood of the previous autumn that he had lost his younger son. "Because of the pumps," he finished.
Pumps?
Bill asked, turning his head a little without even thinking about it. When he stuttered over the plosive sounds, spittle flew from his lips.
"The drainage pumps," his father said. "They're in the Barrens. Concrete sleeves that stick about 3 feet out of the ground."
"Ben Hanscom calls them Morlock holes," Bill said, grinning.
Zach grinned back, but it was a shadow of his old grin. They were in Zach's workshop, where he was turning chair dowels without much interest. "Sump pumps is all they really are, kiddo," he said. "They sit in cylinders about 10 feet deep, and they pump the sewage and the runoff along when the slope of the land levels out or angles up a little. It's old machinery, and the city should have some new pumps, but the council always pleads poverty when the item comes up on the agenda at budget meetings. If I had a quarter for every time I've been down there, up to my knees in crap, rewiring one of those motors. But you don't want to hear all this, Bill. Why don't you go watch TV? I think Sugarfoot's on tonight."
I do want to hear it, Bill said. And not only because he had come to the conclusion that there was something terrible under Derry someplace.
"Why do you want to hear about a bunch of sewer pumps?" Zach asked.
Skuska Hool report, Bill said wildly.
"School's out."
Next year."
"Well, it's a pretty dull subject," Zach said. "Teacher will probably give you an F for putting him to sleep." "Look, here's the Kanduskeag." He drew a straight line in the light fall of sawdust on the table in which his bandsaw was embedded. "And here's the Barrens. Now, because downtown's lower than the residential areas, Kansas Street, say, or the Old Cape or West Broadway, most of the downtown waste has to be pumped into the river. The waste from the houses flows down to the Barrens pretty much on its own. You see?"
"You guess," Bill said, drawing a little closer to his father to look at the lines, close enough so that his shoulder was against his father's arm.
"Someday they'll put a stop to pumping raw sewage into the river, and that'll be the end of the whole business. But for now, we've got those pumps in the... what did your buddy call them?"
"Morlock holes,"
Bill said, with not a trace of stutter. Neither he nor his father noticed. "Yeah, that's what the pumps in the Morlock holes are for, anyway, and they work pretty well except when there's too much rain and the streams overflow. Because although the gravity drains and the sewers with the pumps were meant to be separate systems, they actually crisscross all over the place. See?" He drew a series of X's radiating out from the line which represented the Kanduskeag, and Bill nodded. "Well, the only thing you need to know about water draining is that it will go wherever it can.
When it gets high, it starts to fill up the drains as well as the sewers. When the water in the drains gets high enough to reach those pumps, it shorts them out. Makes trouble for me because I have to fix them.
Dad, how big are the sewers and drains?
You mean what's the bore on them? Bill nodded. The main sewers are maybe 6 feet in diameter. The secondaries, from the residential areas, are 3 or 4, I guess. Some of them might be a little bigger. And believe me when I tell you this, Billy, and you can tell your friends, you never want to go into one of those pipes. Not in a game, not on a dare, not for any reason.
Why?
A dozen different town governments have built on them since 1885 or so. During the Depression, the WPA put in a whole secondary drain system and a tertiary sewer system. There was lots of money for public works back then. But the fellow who bossed those projects got killed in World War II, and about 5 years later, the Water Department found out that the system blueprints were mostly gone. That's about 9 pounds of blues that just disappeared sometime between 1937 and 1950. My point is that nobody knows where all the damned sewers and drains go, or why. When they work, nobody cares. When they don't, there's 3 or 4 sad sacks from Derry Water who have to try and find out which pump went flooey or where the plug-up is. And when they go down there, they damn well pack a lunch. It's dark and it's smelly and there are rats. Those are all good reasons to stay out, but the best reason is that you could get lost. It's happened before. Lost under Derry. Lost in the sewers. Lost in the dark. There was something so dismal and chilling about the idea that Bill was momentarily silenced. Then he said,
But haven't they ever sent people down to map?
I ought to finish these dowels, Zach said abruptly, turning his back and pulling away. Go on in and see what's on TV.
But, Dad.
Go on, Bill, Zach said, and Bill could feel the coldness again. That coldness made suppers a kind of torture as his father leafed through electrical journals. He hoped for a promotion the following year, as his mother read one of her endless British mysteries. Marsh, Sayers, Innes, Allingham. Eating in that coldness robbed food of its taste. It was like eating frozen dinners that had never seen the inside of an oven. Sometimes, after, he would go up to his room and lie on his bed, holding his griping stomach, and think,
He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts.
He thought of that more and more since Georgie had died, although his mother had taught him the phrase 2 years before. It had taken on a talismanic cast in his mind. The day he could walk up to his mother and simply speak that phrase without tripping or stuttering, looking her right in the eye as he spoke it, the coldness would break apart. Her eyes would light up and she would hug him and say, Wonderful, Billy. What a good boy. What a good boy. He had, of course, told this to no one. Wild horses would not have dragged it from him. Neither the rack nor the boot would have induced him to give up this secret fantasy, which lay at the very center of his heart. If he could say this phrase, which she had taught him casually one Saturday morning, as he and Georgie sat watching Guy Madison and Andy Devine in The Adventures of Wild Bill Hickok, it would be like the kiss that awakens Sleeping Beauty from her cold dreams to the warmer world of the fairy tale prince's love.
He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts.
Nor did he tell it to his friends on that July 3rd, but he told them what his father had told him about the Derry sewer and drain systems. He was a boy to whom invention came easily and naturally, sometimes more easily than telling the truth. And the scene he painted was quite different from the scene in which the conversation had actually taken place. He and his old man had been watching the tube together, he said, having cups of coffee.
Your dad lets you have coffee? Eddie asked.
Sure, Bill said.
Wow, Eddie said. My mother would never let me have a coffee. She says the caffeine in it is dangerous.
He paused. She drinks quite a bit of it herself, though.
My dad lets me have coffee if I want it, Beverly said. But he'd kill me if he knew I smoked.
What makes you so sure it's in the sewers?
Richie asked, looking from Bill to Stan Urus and then back to Bill again.
Everything goes back to that, Bill said. The voices Beverly heard came from the drain. And the blood. When the clown chased us, those orange buttons were by a sewer. And George.
It wasn't a clown, Big Bill, Richie said. I told you that. I know it's crazy, but it was a werewolf.
He looked at the others defensively. Honest to God, I saw it. Bill said,
It was a werewolf for you.
Huh? Bill said,
Don't you see? It was a werewolf for you because you saw that hum movie at the Aladdin.
I don't get it.
I think I do, Ben said quietly. I went to the library and looked it up, Bill said. I think it's a
He paused, throat straining, and spat it out.
A glamour.
Glamour? Eddie asked doubtfully.
Glamour, Bill said, and spelled it.
He told them about an encyclopedia entry on the subject and a chapter he had read in a book called Night's Truth. Glamour, he said, was the Gaelic name for the creature which was haunting Derry. Other races and other cultures at other times had different words for it, but they all meant the same thing. The Plains Indians called it Manitou, which sometimes took the shape of a mountain lion or an elk or an eagle. These same Indians believed that the spirit of a Manitou could sometimes enter them, and at these times it was possible for them to shape the clouds themselves into representations of those animals for which their houses had been named. The Himalayans called it a Talus or Telus, which meant an evil magic being that could read your mind and then assume the shape of the thing you were most afraid of. In Central Europe, it had been called Ilok, brother of the Verderlok, or vampire. In France, it was Le Loup-Garou, or skin changer, a concept that had been crudely translated as the werewolf. But Bill told them Le Loup-Garou, which he pronounced Le Loup-Garou, could be anything, anything at all, a wolf, a hawk, a sheep, even a bug.
Did any of those articles tell you how to beat a glamour? Beverly asked.
Bill nodded, but he didn't look hopeful.
The Himalayans had a ritual to get rid of it, but it's pretty gruesome.
They looked at him, not wanting to hear, but needing to.
It was called the ritual of chud, Bill said,
and went on to explain what that was. If you were a Himalayan holy man, you tracked the telus. The telus stuck its tongue out. You stuck yours out. You and it overlapped tongues, and then you both bit in all the way, so you were sort of stapled together, eye to eye.
Oh, I think I'm going to puke, Beverly said, rolling over on the dirt.
Ben patted her back tentatively, then looked around to see if he had been observed. He hadn't been. The others were looking at Bill, mesmerized.
What then? Eddie asked.
Well, Bill said, this sounds crazy, but the books said that then you started telling jokes and riddles.
What?
Stan asked. Bill nodded, his face that of a correspondent who wants you to know, without coming right out and saying it, that he doesn't make the news but only reports it.
Right. The first the Telus monster would tell one, then you got to tell one, and you went on like the vet. Taken to turns.
Beverly sat up again, knees against her chest, hands linked around her shins.
I don't see how people could talk with their tongues, you know, nailed together.
Richie immediately ran out his tongue, gripped it with his fingers, and intoned,
My father works in a shit yard.
That broke them all up for a while, even though it was a baby joke.
Well, maybe it was supposed to be telepathy, Bill said. Anyway, if the human laughed first in spite of the pain,
Stan asked. Bill nodded.
Then the Telus got to kill him and eat him. His soul, I think. But if the man could make the Telus laugh first, it had to go away for 100 years. Did the book say where a thing like that would come from? Ben asked.
Bill shook his head.
Do you believe any of it?
Stan asked, sounding as if he wanted to scoff but could not quite find the moral or mental force to do so. Bill shrugged and said,
I almost do.
He seemed about to say more, then shook his head and remained silent.
It explains a lot, Eddie said slowly. The clown, the leper, the werewolf.
He looked over at Stan.
The dead boys, too, I guess.
This sounds like a job for Richard Tozier, Richie said in the movie-tone newsreel announcer's voice. Man of 1,000 jokes and 6,000 riddles.
If we sent you to do it, we'd all get killed, Ben said.
Slowly, in great pain. At this, they all laughed again.
"So what do we do about it?"
Stan demanded, and once again Bill could only shake his head and feel he almost knew. Stan stood up.
"Let's go somewhere else," he said. "I'm getting fanny fatigue."
"I like it here," Beverly said. "It's shady and nice." She glanced at Stan. "I suppose you want to do something babyish, like going down to the dump and breaking bottles with rocks."
"I like breaking bottles with rocks," Richie said, standing up beside Stan. "It's the J.D. in me, baby."
He flipped up his collar and began to stalk around like James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause.
"They hurt me," he said, looking moody and scratching his chest. "You know, like, wow, my parents, school, society, everyone. It's pressure, baby. It's
shit," Beverly said and sighed.
"I've got some firecrackers," Stan said,
and they forgot all about glamours, Manitou's, and Richie's bad James Dean imitation as Stan produced a package of black cats from his hip pocket. Even Bill was impressed.
"To Jesus Christ, Stestahan, well, where did you get the hose?"
"From this fat kid that I go to synagogue with sometimes," Stan said. "I traded a bunch of Superman and Little Lulu funny books for him."
"Let's shoot him off," Richie cried, nearly apoplectic in his joy. "Let's go shoot him off, Stanny. I won't tell any more guys you and your dad killed Christ. I promised. What do you say?"
"I'll tell him your nose is small, Stanny. I'll tell him you're not circumcised." At this, Beverly began to shriek with laughter and actually appeared to be approaching apoplexy before covering her face with her hands. Bill began to laugh, Eddie began to laugh, and after a moment, even Stan joined in. The sound of it drifted across the broad, shallow expanse of the Kandusky on that day before July 4th, a summer sound as bright as the sun rays darting off the water, and none of them saw the orange eyes staring at them from a tangle of brambles and sterile blackberry bushes to their left. This brambly patch scrubbed the entire bank for 30 feet, and in the center of it was one of Ben's Morlock holes. It was from this raised concrete pipe that the eyes, each more than 2 feet across, stared. 5. The reason Mike ran afoul of Henry Bowers and his not-so-merry band on that same day was because the next day was the glorious 4th. The church school had a band in which Mike played the trombone. On the 4th, the band would march in the annual holiday parade playing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Onward Christian Soldiers, and America the Beautiful. This was an occasion that Mike had been looking forward to for over a month. He walked to the final rehearsal because his bike had a busted chain. The rehearsal was not scheduled until 2:30, but he left at 1 because he wanted to polish his trombone, which was stored in the school's music room, until it glowed. Although his trombone playing was really not much better than Richie's voices, he was fond of the instrument, and whenever he felt blue, a half an hour of foghorning Sousa marches, hymns, or patriotic airs cheered him right up again. There was a can of Sadler's brass polish in one of the flap pockets of his khaki shirt, and 2 or 3 clean rags were dangling from the hip pocket of his jeans. The thought of Henry Bowers was the furthest thing from his mind. A glance behind as he approached Niebold Street and the church school would have changed his mind in a hurry, because Henry, Victor, Belch, Peter Gordon, and Moose Sadler were spread across the road behind him. If they had left the Bowers house 5 minutes later, Mike would have been out of sight over the crest of the next hill. The apocalyptic rock fight and everything that followed it might have happened differently, or not at all. But it was Mike himself, years later, who advanced the idea that perhaps none of them were entirely their own masters in the events of that summer. That if luck and free will had played parts, then their roles had been narrow ones. He would point out a number of these suspicious coincidences to the others at their reunion lunch, but there was at least one of which he was unaware. The meeting in the Barrens that day broke up when Stan Uris produced the black cats and the Losers Club headed toward the dump to shoot them off. And Victor, Belch, and the others had come out to the Bowers farm because Henry had firecrackers, cherry bombs, and M-80s. The possession of these last would a few years hence become a felony. The big boys were planning to go down beyond the train yard coal pit and explode Henry's treasures. None of them, not even Belch, went out to the Bowers farm under ordinary circumstances, primarily because of Henry's crazy father, but also because they always ended up helping Henry do his chores. The weeding, the endless rock picking, the lugging of wood, the toting of water, the pitching of hay, the picking of whatever happened to be ripe at that time of the season. Peas, cukes, tomatoes, potatoes. These boys were not exactly allergic to work, but they had plenty to do at their own places without sweating for Henry's kooky father, who didn't much care who he hit. He had once taken a length of stove wood to Victor Chris when the boy dropped a basket of tomatoes he was lugging out to the roadside stand. Getting whopped with a chunk of birch was bad enough. What made it worse was that Butch Bowers had chanted, "I'm gonna kill all the nips. I'm gonna kill all the fucking nips," when he did it. Dumb as he was, Belch Huggins had expressed it best. "I don't fuck with crazy people," he told Victor one day, 2 years before. Victor had laughed and agreed. But the siren song of all those firecrackers had been too great to be withstood. "Tell you what, Henry," Victor said when Henry called him up that morning at 9 and invited him out. "I'll meet you at the coal pit around 1 o'clock. What do you say?" "You show up at the coal pit around 1 and I'm not going to be there," Henry replied. "I got too many chores. If you show up at the coal pit around 3, I will be there. And the first M80 is going to go right up your old tan track, Vic." Vic hesitated, then agreed to come over and help with the chores. The others came as well, and with the 5 of them, all big boys, working like fiends around the Bowers place, they got all the chores finished by early afternoon. When Henry asked his father if he could go, Bowers, the elder, simply waved a languid hand at his son. Butch was settled in for the afternoon on the back porch, a quart milk bottle filled with exquisitely hard cider by his rocker, his Philco portable radio on the porch rail. Later that afternoon, the Red Sox would be playing the Washington Senators, a prospect that would have given a man who was not crazy a bad case of cold chills. An unsheathed Japanese sword lay across Butch's lap, a war souvenir which, Butch said, he had taken off the body of a dying nip on the island of Tarawa. He had actually traded 6 bottles of Budweiser and 3 joysticks for the sword in Honolulu. Lately, Butch almost always got out his sword when he drank, and since all of the boys, including Henry himself, were secretly convinced that sooner or later he would use it on someone, it was best to be far away when it made its appearance on Butch's lap. The boys had no more than stepped out into the road when Henry spied Mike Hanlon up ahead. "It's the nigger," he said, his eyes lighting up like the eyes of a small child contemplating Santa Claus's imminent arrival on Christmas Eve. "The nigger?" Belch Huggins looked puzzled. He had seen the Hanlons only rarely, and then his dim eyes lit up. "Oh, yeah, the nigger. Let's get him, Henry." Belch broke into a thunderous trot. The others were following suit when Henry grabbed Belch and hauled him back. Henry had more experience than the others chasing Mike Hanlon, and he knew that catching him was easier said than done. That black boy could move. "He don't see us. Let's just walk fast till he does. Cut the distance." They did so. An observer might have been amused. The 5 of them looked as if they were trying out for that peculiar Olympic walking competition. Moose Sadler's considerable belly joggled up and down inside his Derry High School t-shirt. Sweat rolled down Belch's face, which soon grew red. But the distance between them and Mike closed. 200 yards. 150 yards. 100. And so far, little Black Sambo hadn't looked back. They could hear him whistling. "What are you going to do to him, Henry?" Victor Chris asked in a low voice. He sounded merely interested, but in truth, he was worried. Just lately, Henry had begun to worry him more and more. He wouldn't care if Henry wanted them to beat the Hanlon kid up, maybe even rip his t-shirt off or throw his pants and underwear up in a tree, but he was not sure that was all Henry had in mind. This year there had been several unpleasant encounters with the children from Derry Elementary Henry referred to as the little shits. Henry was used to dominating and terrorizing the little shits, but since March he had been balked by them time and time again. Henry and his friends had chased one of them, the four-eyes tozier kid, into freezes, and had lost him somehow just when it seemed his ass was surely theirs. Then, on the last day of school, the Hanscom kid. But Victor didn't like to think of that. What worried him, simply, was this. Henry might go too far. Just what too far might be was something Victor didn't like to think of. But his uneasy heart had prompted the question just the same. "We're going to catch him and take him down to that coal pit," Henry said. "I thought we'd put a couple of firecrackers in his shoes and see if he dances. But not the M80s, Henry, right?" If Henry intended something like that, Victor was going to take a powder. An M80 in each shoe would blow that nigger's feet off, and that was much too far. "I've got only 4 of those," Henry said, not taking his eyes off Mike Hanlon's back. They had closed the distance to 75 yards now, and he also spoke in a low voice. "You think I'd waste 2 of them on a fucking night fighter?" "No, Henry, course not." "We'll just put a couple of black cats in his loafers," Henry said.
then strip him bare-ass and throw his clothes down into the barrens. Maybe he'll catch poison ivy going after them.
We gotta roll him in the coal, too, Belt said, his formerly dim eyes now glowing brightly.
Okay, Henry, is that cool?
Cool as a moose, Henry said in a casual way Victor didn't quite like. We'll roll him in the coal, just like I rolled him in the mud that other time. And
Henry grinned, showing teeth that were already beginning to rot at the age of 12.
And I got something to tell him. I don't think he heard when I told him before.
What's that, Henry? Peter asked. Peter Gordon was merely interested and excited. He came from one of Derry's good families. He lived on West Broadway, and in 2 years he would be sent to prep school in Groton. Or so he believed on that July 3rd. He was brighter than Vic Criss, but had not hung around long enough to understand how Henry was eroding.
You'll find out, Henry said. Now shut up. We're getting close.
They were 25 yards behind Mike, and Henry was just opening his mouth to give the order to charge when Moose Sadler set off the first firecracker of the day. Moose had eaten 3 plates of baked beans the night before, and the fart was almost as loud as a shotgun blast. Mike looked around. Henry saw his eyes widen.
Get him,
Henry howled. Mike froze for a moment, then he took off, running for his life. 6. The losers wound their way through the bamboo and the barrens in this order. Bill, Richie, Beverly behind Richie, walking slim and pretty in blue jeans and a white sleeveless blouse, Zori's on her feet. Then Ben, trying not to puff too loudly. Although it was 81 that day, he was wearing one of his baggy sweatshirts. Stan, Eddie bringing up the rear, the snout of his aspirator poking out of his right front pants pocket. Bill had fallen into a jungle safari fantasy, as he often did when walking through this part of the barrens. The bamboo was high and white, limiting visibility to the path they had made through here. The earth was black and squelchy, with sudden patches that had to be avoided or jumped over if you didn't want to get mud in your shoes. The puddles of standing water had oddly flat rainbow colors. The air had a reeky smell that was half the dump and half rotting vegetation. Bill halted one turn away from the Kanduskeag and turned back to Richie.
"T-t-t tiger up ahead, t-t tozier."
Richie nodded and turned back to Beverly.
"Tiger," he breathed. "Tiger," she told Ben. "Man-eater?"
Ben asked, holding his breath to keep from panting.
"There's blood all over him," Beverly said.
"Man-eating tiger,"
Ben muttered to Stan, and he passed the news back to Eddie, whose thin face was hectic with excitement. They faded into the bamboo, leaving the path of black earth that looped through it magically bare. The tiger passed in front of them, and all of them nearly saw it. Heavy, perhaps 400 pounds, its muscles moving with grace and power beneath the silk of its striped pelt. They nearly saw its green eyes and the flecks of blood around its snout from the last batch of pygmy warriors it had eaten alive. The bamboo rattled faintly, a noise both musical and eerie, and then was still again. It might have been a breath of summer breeze, or it might have been the passage of an African tiger on its way toward the old Cape side of the barrens.
"Gone," Bill said.
He let out a pent-up breath and stepped out onto the path again. The others followed suit. Richie was the only one who had come armed. He produced a cap pistol with a friction-taped hand grip.
"I could have had a clear shot at him if you'd moved, Big Bill,"
he said grimly. He pushed the bridge of his old glasses up on his nose with the muzzle of the gun.
"There's Wawawatusis around here," Bill said. "Can't risk a shot. You want them down onto the top of us?"
"Oh,"
Richie said, convinced. Bill made a come-on gesture with his arm, and they were back on the path again, which narrowed into a neck at the end of the bamboo patch. They stepped out onto the bank of the Kanduskeag, where a series of stepping stones led across the river. Ben had showed them how to place them. You got a big rock and plopped it in the water, then you got a second and plopped it in the water while you were stepping on the first, then you got a third and plopped it in the water while you were stepping on the second, and so on until you were all the way across the river, which here, and at this time of year, was less than a foot deep and shaled with tawny sandbars, with your feet still dry. The trick was so simple it was damn near babyish, but none of them had seen it until Ben pointed it out. He was good at stuff like that, but when he showed you, he never made you feel like a dummy. They went down the bank in single file and started across the dry backs of the rocks they had planted.
"Bill,"
Beverly cried urgently. He froze at once, not looking back, arms held out. The water chuckled and rilled around him.
"What?" There's piranha fish in here. I saw them eat a whole cow 2 days ago. A minute after it fell in, there was nothing but bones. Don't fall off.
Right, Bill said. Be careful, men.
They teetered their way across the rocks. A freight train charged by on the railway embankment as Eddie Kasbrak neared the halfway point, and the sudden blast of its air horn caused him to jiggle on the edge of balance. He looked into the bright water, and for one moment, between the sun flashes that darted arrows of light into his eyes, he actually saw the cruising piranhas. They were not part of the make-believe that went with Bill's jungle safari fantasy. He was quite sure of that. The fish he saw looked like oversized goldfish with the great ugly jaws of catfish or groupers. Saw teeth protruded between their thick lips, and like goldfish, they were orange. As orange as the fluffy pom-poms you sometimes saw in the suits the clowns wore at the circus. They circled in the shallow water, gnashing. Eddie pinwheeled his arms. I'm going in, he thought. I'm going in, and they'll eat me alive. Then Stanley Uris gripped his wrist firmly and brought him back to dead center.
Close call, Stan said. If you fell in, your mother'd give you heck.
Thoughts of his mother were, for once, the furthest things from Eddie's mind. The others had gained the far bank now and were counting cars on the freight. Eddie stared wildly into Stan's eyes, then looked into the water again. He saw a potato chip bag go dancing by, but that was all. He looked up at Stan again.
Stan, I saw.
What? Eddie shook his head.
Nothing, I guess, he said. I'm just a little...
But they were there, yes, they were there, and they would have eaten me alive.
Jumpy.
The tiger, I guess.
Keep going.
This western bank of the Kanduskeag, the old Cape Bank, was a quagmire of mud during rainy weather and the spring runoff, but there had been no heavy rain in Derry for 2 weeks or more, and the bank had dried to an alien crack glaze from which several of those cement cylinders poked, casting grim little shadows. About 20 yards farther down, a cement pipe jutted out over the Kanduskeag and spilled a steady, thin stream of foul-looking brown water into the river. Ben said quietly, It's creepy here, and the others nodded. Bill led them up the dry bank and back into the heavy shrubbery, where bugs whirred and chiggers chigged. Every now and then there would be a heavy ruffle of wings as a bird took off. Once a squirrel ran across their path, and about 5 minutes later, as they approached the low wrinkle of ridge that guarded the town dump's blind side, a large rat with a bit of cellophane caught in its whiskers trundled in front of Bill, passing along its own secret run through its own microcosmic wilderness. The smell of the dump was now clear and pungent. A black column of smoke rose in the sky. The ground, while still heavily overgrown except for their own narrow path, began to be strewn with litter. Bill had dubbed this Dump Dandruff, and Richie had been delighted. He had laughed almost until he cried.
You ought to write that down, Big Bill, he said. That's really good.